selected to demonstrate how he, too, identified with the ordinary soldier. Quote, "Thus nothing that torments you, weighs upon you, and oppresses you is unknown to me. My soldiers, you will therefore believe that my heart belongs solely to you. What I can do for you, my soldiers, by the way of care and leadership, will be done." Unquote. His actions did not match his words. Less than a year later, Albert Speer recalled an evening when he sat with Hitler in the dining car of his personal railway train stopped at a siding. The table was elegantly set with silver, glass, china, and flowers. As we began our meal, none of us at first saw that a freight train had stopped on the adjacent track. From the cattle car, bedraggled, starved, and in some cases wounded German soldiers, just returned from the east, stared at the two diners. With a start, Hitler noticed the somber scene just 2 yards from his window. Without as much as a gesture of greeting in their direction, he peremptorily ordered the servant to draw the shades. It is not surprising that while the German people were still infatuated with the Führer, the German military machine was already becoming disenchanted. High-echelon Wehrmacht officers formed more than one conspiracy to assassinate Hitler. You must seek out opportunities to demonstrate your awareness of the person as an indispensable part of your commercial organism. Great loyalty is acquired by leaders who express concern about an ill spouse. Do you know anything about the children of your employees? Find out what hobbies and sports your employees pursue. These seem obvious features, but in my experience, many people fail at leadership because they fail to convince that they care. It is very difficult to find the balance between caring and effectiveness. But that is the challenge. Maintain balance between short and long-term goals. Another area in which anyone wanting to lead must find balance is short-term versus long-term thinking. Every CEO of a public company knows the struggle between spending the morning trying to develop strategy for the next 3 years and then spending the afternoon with security analysts who care only about the next quarter's results. It is tough, which is why leading isn't for everyone. Parents have to do it constantly. They worry about their children doing their homework, but they are also concerned about long-term career choices. They worry about their children getting home on time from a date, but they also fret about their offspring's capacity to form long-term marital unions much later. Similarly, in your own money-making areas, you have short-term issues, and you have long-term planning. Generally, you attend to the short-term fiscal urgencies while sometimes neglecting the long-term planning. Whether as an executive, a parent, or a reader of this book trying to enhance your revenue-producing capacity, everyone needs to set aside scheduled time on a regular basis for longer-term planning. This is a function of smart time management, and it must be done. Maintain balance between increasing your income and cutting your costs. A final area in which balance must be maintained is the tension between increasing your revenue and containing your expenses. There is obviously a point of diminishing returns if you are spending much of your awake time and much of your energy on cost containment. It clearly needs to be done. But you must also remember that it carries a cost of its own. You need to make regular decisions concerning controlling expenses. But having done so, you must separate yourself from those anxieties in order to be able to focus on revenue growth. As a leader, you must not only maintain this balance, but show those who look to you for leadership that you are aware of both areas, aware of the tension between them, and are maintaining an effective balance. Use body language to look like a leader. I'm about to explain something that fits into the category popularly known as body language. This is an almost imperceptible quality, but an important one. Others use it to determine leadership potential, but are often unable to put into words what it is. Often people feel they are in the presence of a leader, yet when asked what exactly it was that impressed them, most would shrug their shoulders and find it difficult to answer. What I'm about to describe to you should be applied to how you sit at meetings and how you deliver presentations in public. From the outside, it will make you look far more leader-like and more important. From the inside, it will make you feel far more leader-like. It is a behavior that will take you some weeks to learn. During that time, you will need to subject yourself to rigorous discipline. If you do, in due course, this valuable behavior will become second nature. I guarantee that it will play a role in changing your life for the better. Let me first give you some background regarding why appearance is so important to great leadership. Have you ever wondered why popular Western culture depicts the lion as the king of the animals? The lion is neither the strongest nor the largest animal. Among animals, he neither lives the longest nor possesses the largest brain. As a rabbi, I turn to traditional Jewish sources for this answer. More than 2,000 years ago, the Talmud stated that the lion is the king of the beasts. Through his fables taken from the Talmud, Aesop, who had been a Jewish slave by the name of Joseph, for which Aesop is merely the Greek equivalent, had probably carried this royal notion of the lion into Greek culture. In the context of the Talmudic discussion, it becomes clear why Jewish tradition crowned the lion as king. Lions are more economical in movement than any other large animal. I had several opportunities to verify this Talmudic observation because when I was in my early 20s, I rode a motorcycle and camped my way across much of Africa, which afforded me the opportunity of seeing many wonderful animals close up. Even when exploding into action to pursue and kill its quarry, the lion's body seems to flow smoothly, with no unnecessary movement. You would have to be fortunate even to see a lion in motion. Most of the time, he will lie alert, but almost motionless. Only his open eyes and head, occasionally moving slowly from side to side, betray his wakeful state. In contrast, the elephant seems always to be eating, and he constantly flaps his ears or waves his trunk. So do most other animals. The lion's demeanor is regal because of his appearing to have total control over his body. That is impressive. Similarly, as a 10-year-old boy in London, I saw the Queen's guards outside of Buckingham Palace for the first time. I can still recall my father drawing my attention to their ability to stand absolutely still, and I still recall my amazement as I stood and watched them for perhaps 15 minutes. During that August afternoon, I saw a fly crawl across one guard's forehead, and he never budged. I saw sweat rolling down from beneath that large bearskin hat, and the guard never budged. I saw tourists badgering him, and still the guard did not move an eyelash. It was a lesson in power that I had not forgotten. Shakespeare put these words into Hamlet's mouth. "Rightly to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor's at the stake." This is exactly the same principle as demonstrated to me by the lion and the Queen's guard. Greatness in others is shown in part by their careful, deliberate movements that reveal an underlying control of themselves. Consider the opposite. For example, I have always been impressed by Alfred Hitchcock's classic thriller The Birds, based on Daphne du Maurier's novel of the same name. If a studio had asked me to develop an unexpectedly terrifying scenario, I am certain that the brilliant idea would never have occurred to me of turning one of nature's most powerless creatures into the source of terror. What is it about birds that conveys their powerlessness? It is not only their relatively small size, but also the jerkiness of their land-based movements. Naturally, they are far more graceful in flight, but as they walk, their heads dart here and there, and they progress by what seem to be a random progression of jumps and runs, a little sidestep here and a backstep there. Control your physical movements to show self-assurance. You see where this is going, don't you? Stop fidgeting. Are you in a meeting? Stop playing with a pencil. Don't cross and then uncross your legs every 5 minutes. Place your feet on the floor. Find a comfortable place for your hands and keep them there. Talk when you must. Sit as stationary as possible and listen. Be lion-like. Don't allow your eyes to constantly wander around the room. Face whoever is speaking by turning as much of you as possible in the new direction. Instead of allowing your eyes to follow the speaker, rather turn your entire upper body to do so. Looking at someone out of the corner of your eye looks shifty. If you are sitting on a swivel chair, it would be better to swivel your chair smoothly until you are facing the speaker. Above all, avoid constant movement, and when you do move, make it for a good reason, as Shakespeare said. When you must move, make it a smooth, economical movement, moving just as much as necessary, and not a millimeter more. Are you giving a speech? Use your hands and arms to dramatize your points. However, be sure never to keep your elbows tucked into your sides while making fluttering gestures with your forearms. Gesture grandly with your entire arm. Move your arms from the shoulders and never from the elbows. While speaking to a group, do not fix your body in a rigid forward-facing posture. Instead, allow your upper body to swivel smoothly from the waist. Watch the inexperienced speaker's body remain locked into position while his or her eyes dart nervously around the room. The speaker looks nervous, weak, and shifty. You should keep your eyes in place. Sweep your gaze around the room by moving your entire upper body. And one more thing, do not grasp the podium. It will stand without your assistance. Gripping it will only convey the impression that it is you who are in danger of toppling without the podium's reassuring presence. All of this is intended to make you look and ultimately feel regal. But of course, looking and feeling regal are only part of the technique. One must also act regally if one aspires to leadership. Again, the metaphor of the lion is appropriate. Lions never appear to be petty, and neither should you. Nothing undermines your leadership more fatally than the appearance of pettiness. The Talmud advises you to become the tail of a lion rather than the head of a fox. One reason is that lions can often be observed walking with their tails erect, pointing straight up into the air, whereas foxes usually scurry around with their snouts almost on the ground as they follow a scent. The message is, don't associate with cunning and petty little people. Even though they may make you their head, in little time they will succeed in bringing you low. If, however, you succeed in associating yourself with people of stature and true greatness, even if you start off as their tail, they will encourage you, elevate you, and give you every opportunity for growth. The practical lesson here is obvious. When faced with two alternative opportunities that involve different types of people, distinguished chiefly by the lion-like characteristics of one and the fox-like characteristics of the other, choose the lions. Being a lion means doing everything possible to elevate others. Once again, it is a paradox, but this makes you bigger, not smaller. Learn to give presentations without notes. I was 14 years old when I received my first speaking engagement. A visiting group of minor dignitaries was attending a banquet at the synagogue my father served as rabbi. The powers that be had decided that there would be a 7-minute presentation by a representative of the synagogue youth, and because nobody else wanted to do it, the task fell to me. Make no mistake, I didn't want to do it. But Dad, who was a master orator, was impatient to launch my public speaking career and insisted that I prepare a speech. On the way to the event several days later, he asked me if I had carefully prepared my remarks. Because I had watched him prepare hundreds of speeches over the years, I assured him that I had done so. He then asked me if I had written out the speech word for word. Again, I assured him that I had done so. He asked me if I had brought my notes along with me. Assuming he wanted reassurance that I was not going to embarrass him, I reached into my jacket pocket and pulled out the sheaf of papers on which I had carefully constructed my speech. He reached over and took the papers from me. Then, with a sense of horror that I can recall today, with all the emotional intensity of the moment, I watched him rip my notes into shreds and toss them from the car window. I will confess that protesting his littering was the furthest thing from my numbed mind, reeling in anticipation of my impending mortification. He slowly began talking to me. What he said was that I wouldn't understand this action for many years, but that, in the meantime, he wanted me to believe that he acted in my best interests until the day it finally would become clear to me. He then pulled over the car and asked me to say my speech to him. At first, I petulantly refused, saying there was no point, because I had no intention of giving the speech anyway. But finally, I relented and tried to recall my speech word for word. It was horrendous. Dad then laboriously began helping me to reformulate my speech in terms of its three classical components. 1, the introduction. 2, the body. And 3, the conclusion. He divided each component into 3 subsections and then helped me to decide on the 1 key word by which I could remember the contents of each of my 9 subsections. Finally, he helped me recall and memorize 3 key phrases until they could roll off my tongue with fluency. It was then I noticed that we were still in plenty of time for the banquet, and I suspected that we had departed from home so early because Dad had foreseen the entire scenario that had just unfolded. He then told me that I was going to speak to the synagogue group with no notes in my hand or on the podium, and that it was going to be a far more successful speech than the one I had originally anticipated delivering, or to be more honest, reading. Nobody needs to come to an event to hear the keynote speaker read his speech. Everyone subconsciously realizes that it would have been far more economical had the sponsoring organization merely replicated the written speech and distributed it to attendees by mail. No. When one listens to a well-crafted and well-delivered speech, no matter how short it may be, one comes away with a sense of having been granted a glimpse into the speaker's soul. Furthermore, the speech reaches more deeply and more directly into the listener's soul than had he or she merely read the speech in printed form. Abandoning my notes, knowing my subject matter, and being familiar with what I was going to describe next allowed me the luxury of eye contact with my audience. I could focus on gesture and modulation. Dad was right. My little maiden speech did receive more enthusiastic acclaim than a 14-year-old incipient delinquent was entitled to, only because of Dad's intervention. On the drive home, I churlishly failed to thank him for tearing up my notes. But I have done so 1,000 times since, and I have almost never spoken from notes since that day. I tell you all that only to be able to tell you this. Believe me when I say that I know just how hard it is to hurl the crutches into the fireplace and deliver that speech with free hands. That is what notes are to a speech, merely crutches. You do not need them. What is more, once you have given your first speech entirely without notes before you, you will never go back to notes. You will enjoy the experience more than you ever did while speaking from written notes. You will be far more effective, and your words will be more memorable. I will allow that if your work ever requires you to speak about many specific details and figures beyond your capacity to memorize reliably, use a teleprompter, if available. This device is virtually invisible in a large hall, and it allows you to look up at the audience rather than crouching over your notes. Still, try to avoid depending on the teleprompter. I could hardly provide you with more powerful and useful advice than to encourage you to accustom yourself to public speaking sans notes. It really is easier than you suspect. However, you do need a ready vocabulary and an ease of public communication. It is hard to think of any effective leader, whether political, military, or business, who has not been an effective orator. My advice on how to increase your vocabulary and ease of public speaking is deceptively simple. It appears to be so simple that only some of those leaders who have paid me substantial fees for training them in the art of public speaking have actually followed through with the program. It seems too simple to be worth doing. I hope you don't make this mistake. Reading about it and thinking about it are not the same as doing it. You will astound yourself and everyone else if you follow this regimen for 6 to 8 weeks. Read aloud. Yes, that's right. All you need to do is read aloud. It is much easier to do this effectively with an audience. So if you have a friend, a spouse, or a child who will listen to your reading aloud, so much the better. Pick a good book. That is important. Pick a book written in a style that you would like to emulate. George Washington and Abraham Lincoln used the Bible. I myself use the works of Winston Churchill. Again, I must emphasize that it is your own ears that must hear your own mouth shaping itself around the words, so you must read aloud with full intonation and expression. Do this for 20 to 30 minutes a day. I am recommending quite a tough discipline here, I know it. However, the results will themselves soon begin to urge you on. You won't believe the powerful effect this regimen will have on your ability to communicate with others. And without a strong ability to communicate, you can forget about leading anyone. Adopt a mask of command. Throughout this chapter, I have repeatedly emphasized that not only must you act in accordance with the principles of leadership, but you must always be sure to be seen doing so. It is often even more important to be seen that way than to actually feel that way. For instance, necessary qualities for leadership are optimism and courage. It is far more important for, say, a platoon leader to exhibit optimism and courage than it is for him to reflect how he honestly feels. His choices are either to radiate to his frightened and demoralized men an optimism and courage he doesn't feel, or to openly and candidly reveal his own uncertainties and fears. Should he select the latter course of action, he is no leader. Should he select the former, well, won't he feel like a fraud? Leading does mean not always revealing one's inner feelings of doubt. Greater store is set by sincerity than it deserves. For instance, would you rather have your neighbor act generously and graciously toward you, although deep down in his heart he doesn't much care for you? Or would you rather have him scratch your car and kick your cat as sincere expressions of his feelings? Of course, everyone would rather have associates and neighbors act in accordance with a common code of decency than in accordance with whatever their emotional condition of the moment dictated. Similarly, there are times in leading that it is simply inappropriate and counterproductive to reveal doubts, because doing so would undoubtedly cause ripples of morale-sapping fear to spread throughout the organization. How does one develop the vital qualities of optimism and courage? The key principle employed here is one that lies within the heart of ancient Jewish wisdom. It concerns the relationship between how one feels and how one acts. You might mistakenly assume that you act in accordance with your feelings. But the ancient sages teach that in reality you just as frequently come to feel in accordance with how you act. The principle is clear. If you don't like the way you feel about something or about someone, start acting the way you would act if you already felt the way you wished you would feel. And you will soon come to feel that way. Did you get that? Just read it again. Here's an example. Suppose you had an argument with someone important in your life. You spent all day seething in anger at the unreasonable position taken by this person earlier that morning. When you meet the individual again, the argument probably picks up where it left off, or, at best, a glacial iciness envelops the two of you. Here is a better way. If you really did feel wonderful about that person, wouldn't you show it? Well, do the same thing now. Bring a gift to the other person, who probably was at least as angry with you as you were with him or her. Is the gift going to make that person forget the argument and start loving or even liking you? Probably not, although it will probably mystify him or her. What it will do is far more important. Giving the gift will reduce your hostility and bring you to a different frame of mind. Your actions can change your feelings. That is not the same thing as saying that your actions can change someone else's feelings. That is far less likely, although they certainly can do so. It is your feelings that your own actions can certainly change. In the same way, if you act the way you would act if you really were filled with optimism and courage, then pretty soon you actually will start feeling more courageous and optimistic. This may seem as if you are pulling on a mask to wear among the people with whom you work and live. Well, yes, that is true. And if you really want to become more effective, not only in the area of economic productivity, but in all of life, then you need to develop a comfort in yourself about leading, and a comfort in others about being led by you. That sometimes does entail wearing a mask. I cannot say it better than the great military historian John Keegan. Heroic leadership, any leadership, is like priesthood. statesmanship, even genius, a matter of externals almost as much as of internalities. The exceptional are both shown to and hidden from the mass of humankind, revealed by artifice, presented by theater. The theatrical impulse will be strong in the successful politician, teacher, entrepreneur, athlete, or divine, and will be both expected and reinforced by the audiences to which they perform. One of the most exciting aspects of a life in business is that no day is just like the day before. Constant change is both the stimulus and the challenge. Learning how to relate to change is an obvious characteristic, possessed by successful leaders and indeed by all successful business professionals. That is where I lead you next. Your path to prosperity. Learn to follow if you want to learn to lead. Leaders depend on their followers accepting a sense of hierarchy in order to validate their leadership. You stand more chance of making it to leadership if you never missed an opportunity to point out to those around you that your actions are not simply spur-of-the-moment impulses, but are the consequences of accountability to some external entity. For example, it is not uncommon to find conspicuously successful Jewish business leaders who defer many major decisions to an aged parent who was the original founder of the business. Have the courage to persuasively present your vision. Your vision might be a new marketing campaign, or it may be a vision of fairness and integrity. Naturally, you must know how to confront productively, but no leader fears confrontation. Induct your employees into the culture of your organization. Without this, your employees will never participate fully as members of a team, and they will fail to develop internal guidelines that will allow them to use their initiative in the absence of specific direction. Be crystal clear on exactly what you expect from those who look to you for leadership. Ensure that no employee languishes in loneliness. Provide skill training that will allow each employee to contribute to the bottom line. Finally, make sure all your employees have the ability to remain afloat when things get turbulent. Adapt the power of prayer to your business goals. Early each day, find a quiet opportunity to say out loud an affirmation of faith having to do with some business challenge. It need not be lengthy, but it should be stated explicitly, and it should reflect your conviction in what you intend to achieve. Identify as precisely as possible the exact areas in which you intend improving. Then, write down your specific goals. Say your affirmation loudly enough for your own ears to hear, and do this regularly for a period of at least 2 weeks before you dismiss it as ineffective. If you follow these instructions diligently, you will be pleasantly surprised. Make sure you balance short and long-term business goals. In your own money-making areas, you have short-term issues and you have long-term planning. Generally, people attend to the short-term fiscal urgencies while sometimes neglecting the longer-term planning. Whether as an executive, a parent, or a reader of this book, trying to enhance your revenue-producing capacity, everyone needs to set aside scheduled time on a regular basis for longer-term planning. This is a function of smart time management, and it must be done. Make sure not only that you have a long-term plan, but also that those whom you lead are well aware of your long-term views. When addressing immediate urgencies, find ways to express what needs to be done right now in terms of how it advances your entire organization along the track of its longer-term plans. Carry yourself like a leader. Don't fidget during meetings. Look people directly in the eye when speaking to them. Speak authoritatively and be able to give presentations without notes. Improve the quality of your speaking voice so that you sound like a leader. Don't let others know you have doubts. Instead, project confidence, optimism, and courage. The Sixth Commandment. Constantly change the changeable, while steadfastly clinging to the unchangeable. Convert change from enemy to ally by understanding when to enjoy the exhilaration of change and when to fight it and steadfastly defend the unchangeable. Cultural customs and popular habits seem to swing pendulum-like from one extreme to another. At times, people seek adventure for their leisure and high-risk challenges in their work. They revel in swift changes, swooping exuberantly from one trend to the next. Then, at other times, as a society, people swing back to the stable and predictable. People cocoon at home instead of roaming. They vacation at nearby instead of exotic destinations. And they invest conservatively instead of riskily. You can almost hear them crying out, "No more change." Then times change again. The pendulum swings back, and the giddy excitement returns. People abandon stable jobs for the exhilaration of joining a startup company, and they travel the world on their vacations, lusting for the latest thrill. Are human beings creatures of habit, preferring the reassurance of the familiar? Or do humans love the spice that variety brings to life? It is not surprising, considering the complexity of the human race, that the answer is that both are true. One of the most important distinctions you need to learn to make is between those things in your life that should be constant and unchangeable, and the kind of change you should welcome. Sometimes you can control the change you experience, and occasionally you can only react as a canoeist does, caught in the rapids, coping with the wild ride of change by lunging with your paddles to avoid the largest boulders and prevent the canoe from capsizing. Other than that, you try to hang on until the ride calms down and your ability to make meaningful changes to your course increases. One of the most distinctive aspects of the traditional worldview that has always assisted Jews to cope with change is the view that humans aren't merely smart animals, but are qualitatively distinct and unique beings. You may recall the old childhood guessing game of animal, vegetable, or mineral. Well, the view that has informed Jewish wisdom is that there is a fourth category to add to those three? Human. Minerals undergo almost no change through the ages. Marble, for example, is cut from a quarry in Italy and shipped to New York City, where it will form the facade of a bank. The years go by, and the marble remains virtually the same as it was. Finally, the building may be demolished, but the marble is preserved to be reused in another building. Vegetables don't last anywhere near as long as minerals. During the existence of, say, a radish, the vegetable changes more than a mineral does, but its changes are minor. It may grow larger. It may become redder. But it is still just a radish. There is only a small quantitative difference between a ripe radish and one that still needs a few more weeks in the ground. Animals change far more than vegetables. A newborn puppy dog can be almost irresistibly appealing. Yet the same animal a few years later might be a mangy cur, the scourge of the neighborhood. A newborn calf must be nurtured by the far-sighted farmer until it can take its useful place in the herd. That mature cow is very different from the calf it started out as. But once it is mature, it will change very little in appearance or even in milk production. According to this schematic, Judaism makes the claim that humans are indeed unique. Not only does the appearance of a person continue to change throughout his or her life, but so do experience, character traits, and skills. Few people would like to be judged by the way they were 20 years ago. People change, and for the most part they would like to think they change for the better. If you are having a bad time, you can rest assured with the knowledge that things will be different a few months later. Very few people would have described their present lives accurately had they been asked to predict the course of events a year or two earlier. People's lives are constantly changing. That is part of what it means to be human. The other part is the yearning for complete stability with no changes at all to shake up the predictability of existence. The trick is to recognize that yearning as your radish part, or your cow part, and to resist granting it control over your emotional and psychic state. The upper-level human part of your being revels in change. You constantly find within change all kinds of unexpected opportunities to grow and prosper. The Jewish star shows how to balance change with a fixed frame of reference. Paradoxically, the freedom to grasp change eagerly and to squeeze it until it yields its seeds of new opportunity depends entirely on your not being swept away down the river of change yourself. The only way to prevent change from utterly dominating your life until you are driven to distraction by the absence of any fixed framework of reference is to make sure that your life does possess a fixed and unchangeable framework of reference. Your ability to embrace some changes and to profit from them depends on your ability to staunchly resist other changes. Confusing, isn't it? No, not really. A valuable clue exists. The clue to this dichotomy can be found in the Jewish star, otherwise known as the Star of David. Only a few Americans know the significance of the Star of David above the eagle's head on the reverse side of the $1 bill. It is made up of 13 stars that represent not only the 13 founding colonies, but also the 13 sons of Jacob, once Father Jacob had replaced his son Joseph with Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. This often used Star of David symbol actually represents the Jewish goal of maintaining an exquisite balance between eagerly embracing the new and at the same time remaining anchored to those things that don't change. This balance lies at the heart of effectively utilizing change as an ally in your quest for wealth. In geometric terms, the Jewish star is nothing but one equilateral triangle superimposed upon another just like it, but displaced by 180 degrees. In other words, draw a triangle with three sides of equal length. Draw another just like it, but turn it upside down. Place it directly upon the first triangle. Within that simple shape lies a clue to the way humans should function. A triangle is one of the strongest of engineering shapes. That is why the triangle is used as the preferred shape within trusses and girders. Next time you drive over a girder-style bridge, look for triangles. To understand why the triangle is so strong, first look at a rectangle. Imagine constructing a rectangle and then setting it up vertically on one of its sides. Suppose you placed a large weight on its horizontal upper beam and asked a child to push its finger against one of the two vertical arms. The rectangle would easily collapse and fold down flat onto the ground, as can be attested to by anyone who has attempted to sit on a cardboard box and found themselves ignominiously sitting on the floor instead. You could conduct the same experiment with a triangle, standing so it rested on its base with an apex pointed upward. If you brought a weight down to bear upon that apex and pushed against one of the sides, the triangle would not fold. It would only fail when the weight you placed upon it exceeded its load-carrying capacity. The triangle is thus an immensely durable way of linking three elements, which is to say, its three sides. By way of contrast, the weakest way of linking three elements is in the form of a Z, with a vertical middle element. As you can surmise, a weight placed on the horizontal upper beam or element will fold it down, first into a regular Z, and then flat to the ground even more quickly than a rectangle would have collapsed. Although the Star of David is made up of two identical shapes, each comprising three straight lines superimposed on one another and rotated, there is actually another shape that also fits that description exactly. The swastika. Once again, three lines are attached to one another, but this time in the weakest imaginable configuration. If you duplicate the result, rotate it 90 degrees, and lay it on the first three-line shape you made, presto, you have made a swastika. Amazingly, what emerges is that a Star of David and a swastika are identically described conceptual opposites. You might understand this a bit better if you compare it to hearing the sound of someone laughing or crying. All parents have had the experience of racing, heart pounding wildly, into a room where they hear their child hysterically shrieking, only to find the child shrieking with laughter rather than tears. The two sounds are remarkably similar if you have no visible clues as to the emotional state of the person wailing, although in reality they are polar opposites. Similarly, if I just describe a shape made up of two superimposed and rotated identical arrangements of three straight lines, some will draw a Star of David, while others will draw a swastika. Both symbols are intrinsically powerful and accurately represent a world view. In describing the reaction to the introduction of the swastika in 1925, Conrad Haydn, perhaps the best of Hitler's biographers, said, "The effect was so inflammatory that Hitler himself was surprised and pleased." He continued, "In the swastika, historical accident gave Hitler one of his mightiest magic weapons. It was a lucky find. The old German Workers' Party had not come across it. Italian fascism was denied a symbol of such strength. One of its strongest qualities became apparent only in the course of time. Every child could draw it, and its expressive form encouraged people to draw it, even those who did not know what it meant. An uncanny power emanated from the mysterious sign. Hitler could point at it and calmly say, 'It is not knowledge that helps us, but faith.' Similarly, an uncanny, if opposite, power emanates from the swastika's moral mirror image, the Star of David. Its shape describes a fundamental truth of reality, with each side representing a rugged and unbreakable bond between three aspects of life. The three lines, in turn, represent the three fundamental entities of existence: God, human beings, and the tangible material world. Thus it is as if each triangle were telling Jews that strength lies in unifying these three fundamental elements. One's effectiveness as a human being is diminished if one tries to function on a straight line linking any two of those fundamental elements. Instead, all three are needed. If you mistakenly assume that life can revolve about forging a link between God and human beings, but ignoring the material world of forests and factories, swamps and skyscrapers, your life and your effectiveness at living it is drastically diminished. Suppose you try to enjoy this wonderful world by eliminating the spiritual dimension entirely and focusing only on the relationship between yourself, a human being, and the material, tangible world. Well, think again, illustrates the Star of David. That also won't work very well. Finally, perhaps you find human beings to be a blight on creation, and you visualize a perfect world of spiritual and material existence blended into a people-free perfection. Forget it. Without human beings, life is all morally impotent and meaningless. Never can only two of the three sides of totality form an effective and durable union. All three sides are needed. Therein lies the power of the Star of David and the effectiveness of its spiritual message for the Jewish people. Now, why does this powerful symbol, the Star of David, require two triangles? Surely one alone makes a sufficient eloquent case of this three-way link. The answer is that one triangle represents a God-human beings world matrix that never changes, whereas the other triangle depicts another God-human beings world that must always be open to change. The reason the two superimposed triangles are angularly displaced is because that way they resemble two graphs. The first triangle, standing firmly on its base, represents the core aspects of life that do not change and on which you can depend, while everything else around you may shift and take on new and unfamiliar forms. These core aspects include the need for a relationship with your Creator, your family, and your friends, which doesn't change whether you are living in the 1200s or the current year. Neither do basic human motivations and satisfactions vary much. In the Jewish view, God laid out these truths when on Mount Sinai he gave humanity his biblical blueprint, and each passing year finds humanity further away from connection to that moment. This is signified by the narrowing of the triangle as you move up toward its apex. The second triangle, upside down and balanced precariously on its point, signifies the natural and technological world in which each passing year adds to the store of knowledge and control. You can doom yourself in two contrasting ways. One, you can blind yourself to the things that never change. And two, you can blind yourself to those things that must change. Either you can pretend that everything changes constantly with no fixed reference points, telling yourself that a new high-tech business paradigm exists that regards eyeballs on websites as more important than profits. Or you can refuse to acknowledge that the material aspects of existence in the world are constantly changing, remaining rooted in the past, distrusting modernity, and spurning its comforts with Luddite-like intensity. In contrast, the unspoken message of the swastika was that there were no absolutes in the world other than those that emanated from its one connecting point, the Führer in the center. Everything was open to reinterpretation. Just when you thought you were on a line that led somewhere, it abruptly changed direction and then terminated in nothingness. Not surprisingly, the thousand-year Reich only lasted 12 years and 4 months. Innovation and change are a necessary evolution. How can you use this knowledge in your business life? Examine 2 different scenarios. In the first, technology moves unrelentingly forward. You may have heard of the possible apocryphal tale of the Detroit manufacturer of buggy whips early in the 20th century. Although he heard rumors of a newfangled horseless carriage that some chap called Henry Ford was building down the road, he made no changes to his profitable business. Needless to say, he was soon out of business. Similarly, when steel eventually was discovered in the 19th century and began to replace cast iron, a vast part of U.S. and British wealth that lay in the many old-fashioned foundries and iron-casting operations was tossed aside as these now obsolete operations were destroyed and replaced with early forms of steel-making furnaces. Then, Englishman Henry Bessemer invented the Bessemer converter and made possible the economical manufacture of steel, which quickly replaced cast iron as the building material of choice for bridges and other constructions. All the earlier furnaces were scrapped and replaced with a faster and more efficient system. Later, the Bessemer converter itself was replaced with the Siemens open hearth furnace, which in turn was replaced in the middle of the 20th century with the electric arc furnace. Innovation, even in the mature steel industry, is not over. Many mills are encroaching on larger and less flexible operations. This phenomenon is not limited to the steel industry. Many technology firms of the 1990s experienced similar demises as their specialized products and complex patents were leapfrogged by rapidly developing new technologies. In each case of innovation, in any industry, millions of dollars worth of equipment is scrapped. Amazingly, that apparently destructive and wasteful behavior is exactly what leads to greater wealth and to increased standards of living for millions of people. The downside is that people lose money they had invested, and even more wrenching, workers lose jobs during those regular upheavals. Some of the laid-off workers quickly find new and sometimes better employment. Many do not. This is a tough and tragic reality. The choice is either to accept innovation along with the pain of some, or to reject it and assure poverty and pain for almost everyone all the time. But the reality is that there is no way to hold back this progress. As the Jewish Star of David shows, technical knowledge of the world and its practical application expand constantly. The only way for a company to survive over time, whether it is a buggy whip maker or a company like Cisco building complex internet switches, is for it to adapt to change by destroying creatively on a large scale. Corning did this as it moved away from cookware and glass consumer products and into fiber optics. Judaism has taught me that waving a defiant fist at an uncooperative deity is a waste of time. Sometimes there is a choice between 2 undesirable alternatives. For instance, Corning had to choose between the painful alternatives of closing some plants and retooling others to manufacture glass fiber instead of glass bowls, or making no changes and dying a lingering and inevitable death as a great company. It is a mark of maturity to be able to recognize that although both choices are terrible, one is worse than the other. In my own family, It has been fascinating to watch that stage of maturity arrive at different ages for different children. During their early teen years, most of them would retreat into semi-paralysis when confronted by two undesirable choices. For instance, a while back, one of my daughters had to make a choice between two difficult